Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets, where the NASDAQ had a surprisingly strong finish for the first quarter of the year. Ross takes a look at crude, precious metals, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Publisher of Rick's Picks, Rick Ackerman, gives us his opinion on where the stock markets are headed and whether we should fear or embrace AI. He also comments on the push for digital currencies and the state of our banking system. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Editor of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, reports in from San Diego on the state of U.S. real estate and on whether the U.S. dollar can survive an international attack. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how did the markets wind up the first quarter of the year?
This was, you know, if you'd asked me a couple of weeks ago what things looked like, it was a flat trading range with a few sectors going well, such as the NASDAQ, and others doing poorly, like the Russell 2000. But by the time we finish off the calendar quarter, it's looking pretty strong. This week had a lot going for it. We got to be careful, though, because we're going to have some earnings coming up here in the next few weeks. But for now, the calendar ended up well. This was for the NASDAQ, you know, we're up 20% on the quarter. It's the best levels that we've seen since last August. And there's some big names in there that are helping it along. The Microsoft and Apple, which bottomed out very nicely, formed some good bases here during the early part of the calendar quarter, have stepped up just beautifully. So, there is leadership. And there's always a bull market somewhere, and in this case, that has been a sector that's done very, very well. And looking forward here, from a seasonal perspective, we tend to look for the bottoms to be in the latter part of October, and then carry you through into May. That's the best 6 months of the year, and within that, November is usually the kickoff, and that's the best month of the year, whereas April has historically been the second best. So we've got the momentum going here. The money managers and the people who are getting paid for performance are going to have some nice bonuses based upon this calendar quarter, and they love to run things up into periods such as that to make sure that their bottom line works out. So in this case, some nice checks will probably be going out to some of the traders here in the next few weeks.
Are there buying opportunities in the energy sector?
Yes. We had that hard sell-off down into the last couple of weeks there, all the way down, to the $64 to $65 range, and pretty much turned on a dime. The significant thing here is that the net position of the futures markets of the commercials and of the speculators are the most bullish that we've seen since the bottom of the market in 2016. So you've got the smallest position that the speculators have had since then, And the commercials have a very, very small position in their shorts. And so what you've got here is the makings of a pretty good short squeeze as this market turns the corner. And from looking at the monthly charts, we've talked about the fact that we look at these sequential counts where you get 9 consecutive bars of being above or below 4 bars earlier. So a technical reading that we like to work with. And there was a sequential 9 set up here on the crude oil for this calendar month ending March. And we have had only 6 of these since the 1980s. And they have produced very nice rallies off bottoms. So the potential here is that we would have a few months with good upside bias as far as the oil market is concerned. The daily charts are getting a little ahead of themselves right now into overbought territory. Mind you, you know, we've had a rally of $10 off the bottom. So that's a pretty good run. I would suspect that any correction within the next week or two, you could be taking a look at buying some of the oil stocks. You could keep it nice and simple by buying an ETF. The XLE or the XEG in Canada would give you participation in the sector without having to go out and pick favorite stocks there.
What's going on with precious metals?
So precious metals, gold had been leading on the upside as the markets were under pressure here in the last month or so. But when SVB came along and we got a bit of a climactic move over in the financials, the gold-silver ratio topped out at 91, and it had been a pretty good run on the upside there. And since then, just in this last 10 days or so, the GSR has dropped all the way back down to 82. So pretty significant drop, 91 down to 82, showing that anxieties in the overall marketplace are subsiding a bit. And silver has had just a phenomenal move here in this last couple of weeks. You know, we've gone from $20 up to 23.75 on the active futures contract. And on the other side of the coin, gold has topped out and had some real difficulty at the 2000 level. And if anything, I'd like to see the gold do maybe some consolidating in here in the 1950 level being a support for that market right now. The miners have held up very well in that in this last week or so relative to gold. They're participating, I guess, more with the silver market. And if anything there, something like the GDX, which is up at 32, you might be looking at somewhere close to 30, 30 and a half as a potential buying area for that one.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar, quiet week here, still working against the support level down around 102. And so this is testing levels that we saw back in the early part of the year. If anything, you know, it's having some trouble at this point. If we look at the Canadian dollar, it's getting help now, as we sort of mentioned, I think, last week or the week before, where it had been deviating from the oil price. It started to move once again with oil a week or so ago, and as of this week, we got a pretty decent rally on the Canadian, trading around 74. That's up from a low of 72 and a quarter just a couple of weeks ago. And if the oil market continues to provide its bias, as I think it will in the next couple of months, then that could help the Canadian. It's still got overhead resistance up at the 75 level, which was pretty big overhead during the fourth quarter of last year and the first 2 months of this year. So let's see what happens. But I would suggest that 75 is very possible.
A couple of years ago, a sheet of plywood would require you to take out a second mortgage on your house. What's lumber doing now?
Lumber has, well, we know it had that dramatic move up there 2 years ago, and it's been slowly eroding away. We are down now to $370. And put it all in perspective, we're now below the highs, the breakouts that we had of the 1994 high. You know, if anything, starting to think about where the support was in this last 20 years or so. So you might not be seeing it on the store shelves or in the backyard of the lumberyard. But the wholesale price at this point is doing nothing but slowly eroding away. Kind of looks like the marijuana stocks of the last couple of years.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Rick Ackerman next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He's speaking to us from South Florida. Rick, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Indeed a pleasure, Jim. Thanks for inviting me on.
Rick, can you tell us a bit about Rick's Picks and how you have a free trial offer for our listeners?
Oh, I was hoping you would ask. 2 week free trial. Just go to rickackerman.com and click up top on the free trial deal. And I would say head right for the chat room. Say hello. Just to mention that you were visiting at courtesy of Jim Goddard and Hal Street. And the chat room's a great place. We've got some amazing traders in there, all different styles, and they kind of hang with my own system, the Hidden Pivot system. But yesterday we've got a very knowledgeable guy who posts his Spartacus, who shorted pretty boldly 50 of the SPY calls just out of the money. He got, I think, $1.76 for them, and by the end of the day he was covering them for under a dollar. So it was a quick $3,000 or $4,000. And a lot of those trades happen in the chat room, just people sort of tossing them out. Very helpful place. And of course, you've got my lively, in-your-face, provocative commentary and some what I call touts that are about eight or nine of them that give you a good feel for the markets as a whole. We track gold, oil, E-mini S&Ps, the dollar, bonds, interest rates, and some things, and they give you a pretty good feel for what's going on. So again, just go to rickackerman.com and click on free trial and be sure to say hello.
Last week, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by a quarter point. Earlier in the month, the Bank of Canada stayed firm on rates. Where do you see interest rates heading from here?
Higher. You know, that was pretty amusing, entertaining last week because, of course, the speculation was reasonably tipping in the way of, well, maybe they'll just pause because we've just had the second and third largest bank failures in the history of the country occurring a couple weekends earlier. So here was the Fed on the heels of a bank collapse and the raising interest rates, which of course was where the troubles for the banks began. They're all holding treasury paper. A lot of that paper is underwater. And, you know, the regional banks, we almost had a run on them, really, with people taking the money out and going to the quote-unquote safety of the big four banks that presumably would be bailed out in any event. But as it turns out, we bailed out the regional banks to the tune of I think it was $9 trillion that doesn't even exist, but that didn't seem to matter. Anything is good enough to calm Wall Street, and we're, of course, off and running again on the broad averages.
Now, we're hearing conflicting stories here. Some folks still believe the stock markets are about to crash. Others believe they're going to head higher going into next year. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's that phrase about to collapse. And, of course, you could have been saying about to since 2009. And, of course, most of the way you'd be pretty wrong, except for a few days over that entire 14-year period when you were right. So you can imagine, you can sort of extrapolate out the odds of making money buying put options over 14 years. We've just had a few days when holders of puts felt anything like exhilaration. So it's just not a good bet, although I think it's 100% certitude, absolute lockup bet if you're going to say you're going to bet there's going to be a crash eventually. So the bull market has certainly, we're in a bear market now, but the bear rally that's been going on since October is showing a lot of persistence, mainly because it's drawing its power from doubters. And I'm not going to say absolutely that we can't go to new highs. When I look at the chart, it certainly favors the bearish case, the fact that we're in a bear market, but I can't quite look at that chart and say, no way we're going to new highs. And of course, it draws its energy entirely from the rally, from a short covering. And as students of the market with even short memories may realize and recall that this latest phase of the bear market rally came with expectations that the Q4 earnings reports were going to be horrendous, which they were. And so here were these earnings, but they'd already been sold to death before they even were announced. And so the market had nowhere to go up, but up when all the crummy earnings were being reported.
Could the reserve status of the U.S. dollar be in jeopardy?
You know, all that blather really is amusing. You know, the no one's really thought it through, as far as I can tell, especially the people who write on the subject for journals of opinion and what we laughingly call newspapers these days. But nobody really wants to be the currency of reserve status. Even the Chinese don't want that. They'll accept that, and if it finally does occur, they're going to be, I guess, proud of it without boasting. But you know, the reserve currency carries certain perks like seniorage, where everybody has to borrow in your money, and you wind up essentially exporting debt paper in exchange for currency. So the U.S. has financed a lot of its debt with foreign savings, but nobody really wants to be the reserve currency. And there's really no currency that's big enough to accept that role, to even step into it inadvertently. There's just too much need for dollars. And to some extent, you know, you can have the dollar supplanting or foreign currencies supplanting the dollar in transactions, most significantly in payment for energy, crude oil, natural gas. But that's about it. And when you talk about the dollar being co-opted, it's I'd say it's close to impossible, because even though when you read that the Russians and the Chinese and Iran are starting to exchange currencies other than the dollar for energy resources, crude oil and gas, it's not even. Oil's a big market, but it's not even a drop in the bucket compared to the market in which the dollar is used primarily. And I'm speaking mainly about leveraged financial instruments, such as we find in the derivatives markets. So to say that the dollar will step into a role of importance simply because it's used in transactions, it's that doesn't even get a blip on the radar of money. Because the whole global economy, all trade in goods and services amounts to a paltry $200 trillion at most, but the uses to which the dollar is put in leveraged financial instruments exceeds $2 quadrillion. So we've got that's where the dollar is really needed, and I don't see any chance that the dollar will be somehow replaced in those markets. If they had 100 years to do it, they couldn't.
And also, from the darkest jungles of Africa, with somebody in a dugout canoe or someone in Australia playing a didgeridoo, you show them a greenback, they know exactly what it is and what it's worth.
Yeah, and that shouldn't be lost on anybody who thinks, well, if this regional, the collapse of the banks comes back, that we really have a serious run on regional banks, that those paper 5s, 10s, 20s, 50s, and 100s won't have the same status and utility in this country initially, serving in a kind of barter. And that's acknowledging that the dollar is worthless. You know, every dollar in your wallet is backed by, well, just indebtedness. So, but that's the convention of using dollars is going to supersede at whatever suspicions we have about it based on the dollar not being backed by any asset.
The gold and silver bulls are out in full force. Do you think their bullishness is warranted?
Oh, yes. You know, we're most surely in a bull market in gold, although I had to marvel at the fact that the sleazeballs who manipulate the price of gold for a living and who have lines to the federal government that enable them to borrow gold without any actual physical gold changing hands, they've had a pretty good deal for a while, but you can see that they're still nominally in charge because gold, even in this bull market, has these days when for absolutely no reason at all, it'll be down, you know, $50. But, we're in a bull market, but it's certainly not in the rampaging stage. And, there's a little more hesitation at the 2000 level in gold than I might have expected. But yeah, I think you can trust that gold's in a bull market. And I think it's an encouraging sign. The GDXJ, which tracks, what you call the junior miners, exploration companies, was relatively resilient, on this last shakedown. But also one cautionary note is that, you know, silver was a little bit, more resilient than gold. And of course, silver, strength in silver relative to gold, is considered an indicator of late stage uptrend. And I'm speaking really of a minor uptrend within a larger bull market in bullion.
Could we be witnessing real estate's last hurrah?
I think we've seen it already. There was an interesting story in the journal about how home prices are falling in the western United States and rising in the east. But I don't see too many signs of actual rising among friends of mine who own homes who are either trying to buy them or sell them or whatever. The market is pretty soft, and there are a lot of buyers just sort of hanging tough. In fact, they'd sooner rent a place that's barely affordable than take the plunge in what they must view as overpriced real estate. So the buyers are holding off, even if it means renting for some exorbitant sum. And what it does is create a kind of invisible softness in the market. You don't have a lot of transaction volume in residential real estate right now, but I think the buyers are just sort of and even the renters are kind of dropping back and saying, I don't have to get too stoked about buying a place. And we talked last week about a particular market, Las Vegas. I know a little bit about the market because a friend of mine administers the refurbishment of homes that are that have been acquired by these speculative companies that are renting, just buying the rent. And sometimes they refurbish the places so that they're more rentable. And one company has several thousand properties in the city, and 10% of them are vacant. And rather than reduce rents, which would bring down the equity value of all the homes that they own in this area, They simply are offering renters incentives, which is a quiet way of dealing with the soft market.
Is the rental market built on quicksand foundations?
Well, I mean, with respect to the big players, the private equity that went into buying spec housing to rent in a huge way, they manifestly negatively selected their tenants. You know, they're mostly who will be renting a house? Well, it's someone who can't afford a house. So I would say, just going into this model, they're dealing with, let's say, less than sterling credit risk on the rental side. And we know that every American is living kind of hand-to-mouth, at least Americans below the level of zillionaire. And so the companies that are renting homes to them are probably more vulnerable than they've imagined, because they bought the top of the market in real estate, and they paid top dollar to get these places refurbished relatively quickly, based on what their bean counters told them, which was, hey, look, don't worry how much we pay for this place or what we pay to spruce it up. We're on a 10-year accrual here, and if you work the numbers 10 years out, we got to make money. But, of course, they're factoring the old assumptions about eventually real estate just keeps heading higher. And you can't lose long-term if you're in it.
Is ChatGPT, artificial intelligence, just next-level programming or something much worse?
It's the next wave in stupidity, really. There's so much AI hubris that you got to take a step back. You know, when I think of AI, I think of my idiot autocorrect on my phone. You know, it can't even spell a word right, and it, you know, there's that joke about, you know, a priest and a rabbit walk into a bar, and the bartender says, well, we don't see many of your kind here, not many rabbits. And the rabbit said, well, I'm only here because of autocorrect. So, anyway, the same blithering idiots who gave us autocorrect are the ones who were, they haven't gotten driverless cars right for sure. You know, every year driverless cars get pushed back another 5 years, and some of the really big players, like billions of dollars players like Ford Motor, GM, they've just dropped out of the game. So I have no real faith in AI. And even when I tested out ChatGPT with my own knowledge of deflation, I found that it's an idiot. And as we talked about last time, that makes it a great candidate to be a dominant force in the writing of pretty much everything. It's like, who's going to notice if you've got an idiot computer that's searching for the most innocuous answer to any question? You know, it's basically answering the question in a way where, well, it could be right and it could be wrong, but it's definitely not willing to hazard much of an opinion. And I don't think that's going to be a shortcoming at all with respect to rolling it out to all of America and all of the world, because very few people know the difference between good writing and bad.
Now, Elon Musk and several high techie people have said there should be a 6-month moratorium on AI development, so we can develop a way to make sure it doesn't turn into Skynet and want to wipe out humanity. Are their concerns real? Should we be concerned, or are we just worried that the sky might fall?
No, what Elon Musk didn't say, but which I'm sure he's thinking, you know, what he said was a bit of a MacGuffin. The real fear here, and this would not just be Musk's fear, is that the development of AI is in the hands of the scumballs, you know, and we're talking about Zuckerberg and broadly speaking, Silicon Valley. And we know where their political sympathies lie. So, you know, what you get in AI, if you ask it a question that has any shading of political, if there's any contentiousness at all in it, you get to see which way ChatGPT is leaning already. And, that's the problem. You know, when you got a guy like Zuckerberg who has infinite money to devote to the development of AI, how can you infer that he's going to push it in any direction other than the way Facebook has pushed. So the strongest, the lift for AI, the blast off is in the hands really of companies that have taken a kind of hard turn to the left in everything that they do. And so I think that's Musk's real fear, that the developmental stage of AI, at least to the extent that it's been rolled out for mass consumption, is it's politically skewed.
Do you think central bank digital currencies will gain traction?
Ha, ha, ha. We have digital currency. It's called credit cards. And they're doing the job with just maybe a 3 or 4% VIG in it for the suppliers of credit, to banks. So, yeah, we've got a digital currency system. And it's funny, there's so many, get ready for the new digital currency. There's so many of those stories, and it's such a laugh. It's almost like the front page, the news pages were being dominated completely by stories about UFOs. So all the talk about a digital money, who the hell has even thought, anybody who's writing about it, get ready for it, they couldn't possibly have thought it through. Because, as I said, we've got digital money already. It is called credit cards, and they're doing the job. So what kind of digital money are they talking about, really? If it's crypto, crypto is a flop out the gate, even though the blockchain had the potential to create a transactional medium. It never did it in a cost-effective way that was competitive with credit cards. So even though, as we speak, Bitcoin is trading for $28,580, and I would put a value, I think it's probably closer to being worth $3 or $4, and that's simply because it does have, the blockchain has great utility for data storage, for secure transactions and all that. It's a great idea. But as far as what it's done in the area of money, it's just spawned a speculative medium, and that's all it is. Nobody actually buys and sells things for Bitcoin except in a kind of token way. It's a purely speculative medium. So anyway, all these idiots who are doing stories about, hey, the digital currency's coming, get ready for it, ask them to tell you what kind of digital currency are you talking about? And believe me, they're going to sound like, it's going to be a lot of blather, however they answer that question.
If the government bans cash, what happens then?
Well, when they ban cash, we're already in a state of barter anyway, and the government won't have much control over that because we'll be bartering for things that we need to survive. And just sort of looking at the Soviet experience of bartering, it will find a way regardless of what the rules are. Way before Glasnost, the Russian government maintained the illusion of parity between the ruble and the dollar, but any American with the wherewithal to be traveling in Russia could get 8 rubles for a single dollar. So there'll be black markets, but as far as the government banning currency, by the time anything so radical as that would be tried, we're in a state of we're back in the Paleolithic age.
Is the state of the U.S. and world banking system in a lot worse state than the government claims it is?
Well, yes, and the discrepancy between the two becomes egregious, grotesque, and laughable when it's Janet Yellen telling us how great everything is, that we're all right, and we've essentially backstopped the regional banks with something I mentioned earlier, $9 trillion that we don't even begin to have. The FDIC is good really to cover the failure of, let's say, one medium-sized bank and a half. So forget about the FDIC if there's a run on the banks. And the peculiarity there is that the only way we have to sort of keep the system running the next day after, a mass bank failure would be the credit card system or digital banking, to the extent that you've got money in your checking account and your savings account that you could access online. But unfortunately, by that point, the misplaced faith that we have now that sustains our currency system would be completely gone. So that that would wipe out the clearing mechanism that gives you the ability to go to an ATM, you know, put a card in, punch in a few numbers, and get a few hundred dollars in fresh 20s. So we really don't have a way of transitioning if we do have what I think is an inevitable bank collapse. The branches typically don't hold more than 25 or 50 K, so don't bother standing in line outside the bank when some news story comes that awakens people to the true condition of the banks.
What can a person do to protect themselves from a shaky banking system?
Well, we keep coming back to this, and I like the plan that my friend Charles Hugh Smith has worked out. I think he's the best blogger out there, certainly one of them, and his blog is called Of Two Minds, and he moved to a place where he can grow great things in his backyard, and he's kind of growing them according to their nutritional value, with an emphasis, last time we heard from him, on breadfruit, which, as you remember, was the cargo of the Bounty in the story, the Mutiny on the Bounty story. You know, Britain wanted a cheap source of nutrition to feed the slaves who were working the sugar cane fields in the Caribbean. So in any case, we're going to get there eventually.
Are there any sectors you really like right now?
Well, you got to hate them all, but you can hate less the ones that benefit from government waste and extravagance. So you can't. I think you have to like the defense contractors and the banks up until the very last, until the very end, and of course the healthcare industry. And as much as we all hate big pharma, and as much as Biden blathers on about we're going to rein all those companies in, I don't see much evidence of that, especially watching television, where in prime time maybe half the commercials are drugs, and they never run out of drugs. And the amazing thing is every commercial is a different drug. So if you got to pick winners, you need to be absolutely cynical about it and buy the stuff that the government is wasting a lot of money on.
I'm always amazed that people would buy a drug when they list the side effects includes dry mouth, headaches, and death.
Right, that's right. Yeah, you can put that story out no matter what you're talking about, and even in the Wall Street Journal a week ago had a story about that was under the headline "America Has a Sandwich Problem," and you'd think the woman who tackled that story for the journal would go lightly on that topic, like, okay, sandwiches are not necessarily good for you, but she went in the direction of she really threw everything she had at it. You know, I can imagine the kind of person she is. She's really sort of a nutrition scold, but she said, oh yeah, the processed meats, probably one sandwich will give you your minimum required sodium intake for the next 4 years. And not even mentioning, let's say, a submarine sandwich with capicola and gitagine and ham and salami and all that. So she said, yeah, it's not just the salt, but all those processed meats are associated with different kinds of cancers. And of course the bread, even if you're using all but whatever single type of bread she recommended, and believe me, just because it's brown bread, that doesn't quite cut it. But she said the bread turns to sugar the instant it touches your tongue, which is a bit of an exaggeration. So when you look at these drugs and the contraindications, and you know that aspirin never would have made it to the drugstore counter if anybody had looked closely there.
Well, in France, Subway's bread is not allowed to call itself bread because it has too much sugar in it. The French say that it's more of a pastry.
And I think they're right. Not that the French are ever right about much of anything, but when you taste, like there's a Jewish style bread, it's called challah, and it's the bread tends to be a little bit yellow. And I, someone mentioned to me, I love this stuff. You toast it, or you make French toast out of it, and I've discovered that I love it because it's probably the most sugary of all breads. But yeah, there's definitely the carbohydrate content of bread is it's why it tastes so good.
Rick, how can people sign up for your free trial offer and subscribe to your newsletters?
Just go to rickackerman.com, and up top you'll see free trial, and just click. You don't have to leave a credit card number or anything like that, just your name and email, and you'll be instantly admitted to Rick's Picks. We do a lot of cool things there. There's the chat room that I mentioned earlier, and the touts, which will give you a precise overview of market trends and things like that. So stick around. You'll find when you get to the chat room that we speak a little bit of jargon. There are just a few terms that we use that are particular to my trading system, but it winds up being beneficial because in the room everybody is on the same page with respect to technical analysis. They all use my hidden pivot system, and so it's good teamwork, and the community comes up with a lot of very, very profitable trades.
Rick, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me on, Jim. I always enjoy connecting with you and your audience.
My guest has been Rick Ackerman, editor of the newsletter Rick's Picks, his website rickackerman.com. He was speaking to us from South Florida near a very warm and breezy beach. Now we zip west to San Diego next to talk to Robert Campbell and real estate.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of the realestatetiming.com newsletter. He's speaking to us from San Diego. And how can people find you online?
Hi, Jim. People can go to realestatetiming.com, just like it sounds, realestatetiming.com, and find out what I do. I time 35 different real estate markets in the United States, just like some people tell you when to buy and sell the stock market. Except I do it for real estate. And I've developed a system that is, thankfully, extremely accurate in calling the peaks and valleys of real estate.
And when does the next issue of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter come out?
It comes out in May 15th. I just published the March 15th issue a couple weeks ago, and I publish it every 2 months.
Can you tell us about your book, Timing the Real Estate Market? Is it still just as good today as when it first came out?
Yeah, it is. Because I tested it thoroughly from the start, and I still use the same five key indicators to put into my model to time real estate markets, and it's just as accurate. I've published the fifth edition because I update it to show people that buy the book that it is still accurate. It just didn't work during, you know, one cycle or two cycles. It's been consistently accurate, you know, for the last 50 years.
Could interest rates be the eye of the hurricane?
Yes, they certainly could be there, because the after we hit like a 2,000-year low in interest rates back in 2022, and now with inflation rearing its head, rates have rebounded rather dramatically, and with inflation still being the problem it is, that I think this is kind of the eye of the storm, and that rates are going to go higher, and so is inflation.
Is debt the elephant in the room?
Absolutely. The problem we have, with respect to inflation, if you're looking at the United States, the last inflationary period we had was in the mid-60s through the 70s, and what was different in that period than it is now was that the debt-to-GDP ratio in the United States was around 25-30%. Today it's around 120%. So this is the problem today, guys. It's the amount of debt that's in the system. You can't get away from it. We are just so deeply in debt, and that's what's ultimately going to bury us. Because even if you keep interest rates low, when you keep adding on to the debt, it eventually gets to you. I did a study here in the United States starting at the year 2000. And in the year 2000, from the year 2000 through the year 2022, that the GDP in the United States increased by 160%. The national debt increased by 450%. In other words, during that 22-year period, debt increased three times faster than the amount of goods and services that are being produced in the United States. And that's just the road to ruin, guys. That's just pure mathematics. I mean, and we're never going to get to 100%, because, I mean, it'll blow up way before then, but that's the road we're on. You just get so deep in debt, you have no options. And talking about how deeply in debt we are right now, with the rise in interest rates in the last year, the servicing the U.S. debt of $31 trillion is $850 billion. It was like $250 billion only like 5 years ago. So it's going to approach $1 trillion a year, that probably this year in 2023. And because U.S. tax receipts are in the neighborhood of $4.5 trillion every year, when you have $1 trillion worth of debt servicing, something like 22% or so of all tax revenues are going to go to service the national debt. That's huge. And that thing could keep rising and rising and rising. So when you add that on to the entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, that consumes all the tax revenues. So there's no money left to run the government or pay for the military. And that's why the deficits are going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the only way that they can deal with that is add more to the debt and just print more money.
Does debt to GDP matter?
Absolutely. A book was written, This Time is Different, by Rokoff about 10 years ago. And it studied 500 years of history where governments that let debt get out of hand like we're doing, and anything over 90% debt to GDP ratio kind of puts you in the danger zone where pretty soon things blow up. In other words, you turn into a third world country. At 120% debt to GDP, I mean, this is a real, real problem for the U.S. Nobody wants to talk about it, but it is.
Does debt limit people's options and allow them to be controlled?
Yes, it does. I mean, once you're in debt, I mean, now you need to be, protected by the government just to keep from, going bankrupt or blowing up. So, like, now that we're in this real estate down cycle, and what I think is an economic down cycle, I'm telling everybody, deleverage as much you can. Get out of debt. The time to leverage is during up cycles, not down cycles. So, I mean, even something as simple, if you need a new car, don't go out and buy, an $80,000 car that's going to be an $800 a month payment. No, don't do that. Buy a cheap used car so that you can survive, because the debt will eat you alive.
Is there a correlation between debt and times of war?
Yeah, there is. I mean, the inflation that we had during the 70s in the United States was closely tied to the Vietnam War. That, President Johnson said, we can have guns and butter. We can have the best of both worlds. All we got to do is print money to pay for the Vietnam War and add it to the national debt, and everything will be fine. Well, it wasn't fine. you know, ultimately in the early 80s, inflation rose to 13.3%. Mortgage rates went to 18-19%. The Fed funds rate, I think, went to 22%. And at that point in time, we were 30% debt to GDP. Let's just use that number, 30%. Now we're at 120. If we should get into that kind of scenario where we have to raise interest rates above the rate of inflation, which is the only way to stop it, the, you know, the servicing the national debt wouldn't be $1 trillion a year. It'd probably be $2 trillion. And, you know, it would just be a disaster. And what you'd end up doing, you'd have to end up printing money. The Federal Reserve would have to end up printing money just to cover the debt servicing on a growing national debt. And when that happens, the end is near. You know, what you're going to do is you're just going to have a collapse where everything, you just can't keep everything. You can't keep everything the way it was. Inflation gets out of hand.
Does inflation ever decrease?
The rate of inflation changes. Inflation, if you go back and look at the rate of inflation in the United States going back to 1970, there was only two periods of time, and they were a very small period of time where the inflation, consumer price index ever went down. And I think one was during 2008, and it went down like 2 or 3%. For a short period of time before it started resuming, and one other period where it down 1%. But because the U.S. Fed has a printing press, there is never going to be a deflation. There's never going to be a deflation, guys. They will just print money to keep the wheels on the car. And that's what they've always done, and that's what they will continue to do until it just gets, you know, crazy with high rates of inflation, high interest rates, and, you know, the economy just, it'll come to a standstill is what's going to happen. Everything then will, that you're either going to inflate everything away with very high rates of inflation, or you're just going to let them collapse.
What is considered hyperinflation, and could it be a concern?
Well, hyperinflation, you know, that's always subject to where you want to draw the line. But I think hyperinflation, I would put hyperinflation at a point like 50% a year. You're hyperinflating the currency. I mean, does that compare with the Weimar experience back in the early 20s in Germany? No. Or what's going on in Venezuela now? No. Or what's going on in Zimbabwe? No. But if inflation got up to 50% in the United States, that's hyperinflation. Because, you know, mortgage rates would be 60% a year. Nobody would be able to buy a house. Nothing would function because this is really important to understand, guys. People don't keep up with inflation. Inflation eats you alive. So I don't care that if you, like, you get a 10% raise. If inflation goes off at 12%, you just lost 2% of the purchasing power of your money just on that and that alone. So when it gets up to real high levels, people just can't afford it. And like a rental property, you might say that, okay, you know, real estate will hold its own during inflation because it's a real asset. And that may be true to some respect. But all of a sudden, renters can't pay, you know, a super high rent. And then all of a sudden, the government usually steps in during those periods of time and say, you can't raise the rents because nobody can afford the rent. You know, the government, you know, puts a cap on rent. Okay. That's fine, but then all of a sudden the water heater breaks, and replacing a water heater so that, you know, fair market rents and this hyperinflation should be $5,000 a month, but the government caps it at $2,000 a month, but the water heater breaks, or the roof needs to be replaced. The water heater isn't $1,500. Now it's $15,000. The landlord doesn't have $15,000. So in other words, now the maintenance goes to hell and the place becomes unlivable, or the roof leaks. So it's a no-win situation. You're not going to cap anything. You know, it just gets out of control and the currency becomes valueless, and it's one of the most destructive economic events that can occur. Super high levels of inflation.
What happens when credit gets tightened?
When credit gets tight, I mean, we live in a credit economy, but when you look at the M2 money supply, you have to understand that about 98% of that money supply is credit. So when people live on credit, and business grows on credit. So when credit gets tight, that means people can borrow less money, they can engage in less business activities. They can afford, they can't buy the car they need. They can't buy the house they need. And it leads to economic contraction.
Could the U.S. dollar crash?
Yes, it could crash. I mean, anything can happen. I'm not going to speculate on could it crash, but as many of your the followers of House Street may know, that Russia and China are joining forces, along with India, along with Brazil, along with Iraq, along with South America, and all these other countries, and they're starting to use their own specific currencies as opposed to the U.S. dollar for a variety of reasons, a lot of them political. They don't like what the U.S. is doing in the world right now. And they and eventually, when they go around the dollar, that means less demand for the dollar. But will the dollar crash? That I don't know.
What could cause the U.S. dollar to crash? If the BRICS, as they're called, decide to gang up on them? Or would it just happen naturally? They're a bigger trading bloc, so they invent their own currency or perhaps use the Chinese yuan?
Well, what comes to my mind, what could cause hyperinflation in the United States is, let's say U.S. inflation continues to rise. That, you know, because the U.S. just keeps printing money. Inflation goes from 6% to 10% to 14% to 20%. There's something like foreigners, the world runs on U.S. dollars. So foreigners who hold U.S. Treasury debt, and there's about $3 trillion of it around, all that money that they're holding would be devaluing, you know, on a daily or weekly basis. So nobody's going to want to hold that U.S. debt because it's coming worth, you know, more and more less valuable. So they're going to take all that debt and all that foreign debt, all that debt that's outside the USA, it's going to come home. It's going to come home to the United States, and people are going to want to sell the U.S. debt and get another currency or real estate or gold and silver or oil or some other physical asset. And so when all those that $3 trillion worth of currency comes flooding into the U.S., that could hyperinflate the currency right there. Hyperinflate it. Because U.S. interest rates would go, you know, from you know, whatever the 30-year bond is trading at right now, 4%. It could go to 14%. It could go to 20%, you know, to find a taker. Because who's going to buy it? I don't know, the Federal Reserve. So if all that money comes home, that $3 trillion worth of currency in the form of bonds, that could hyperinflate the currency right there. That's the most likely thing that will cause hyperinflation.
Are we on a trajectory towards revolution?
The lessons of history say yes, because what we're seeing today is that the government, let's just talk about the U.S. government, not other governments. I mean, it applies to Canada, applies to Europe. They're becoming more and more authoritarianism. And at some point, you get to the point where people just say no more. And people think it takes a huge percentage of the people to invoke a revolution. It doesn't. If all of a sudden somebody did something, all it takes is 1% of the population to say, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to stand our ground. And that would be enough to disrupt the whole thing and that would start the revolution. Other people would join forces. The people that aren't as, you know, stand their ground and won't let people mess with them, the other people will join in. But that's all it takes. All it takes is 1% of the people go, you're not doing that to me. You're not going to do that to me. You know, you're not going to do this. You're not going to put a chip in my arm and track wherever I go. You're not going to turn all the currency into digital currency so that you can track everything for a variety of reasons. No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to get vaccinated. I don't care. We're not. No. Yeah, come to my home and try to do that. You know, I'll tell you one thing, whoever knocks on my door, that, you know, that there's going to be a new job opening in that career, because that guy's going to be dead. All it takes is 1%. 1%. And once you start exceeding your power to such a point that only the 1% stand up and say, I won't take any more of this, the revolution starts.
What's the latest?
When it comes to that, I don't see the government backing down, but that's what will happen. I mean, we had a Revolutionary War in the United States when we broke off from England, and I think it was based on taxation what the history tells us, it was based on taxation. I've heard other stories that they didn't want the people living in the United States to own weapons. And they said, screw off. And then the revolution started. So these are all natural occurrences and human events, you know. And it seems like everybody's reaching for so much power now. So much power. You can't do this. You can't go there. You know, you can't travel outside of the state of California unless you have this, this, and this, and all this stuff. And there's a certain percentage of people that are just going to say, no, I'm not going to do that. And all it takes is 1%. And they band together and stand tall. And they said, and then the revolution starts.
What's the latest on the housing markets?
Housing market in the United States is slowly deflating. California is the weakest housing market as a state in the United States. And the reason it hasn't, sales are off somewhere between 30% and 40%, which is huge, yet prices are only marginally down in a lot of areas. However, some areas are down quite a bit, like in San Francisco, which is the weakest housing market in the country. Housing prices from peak values back in May 2022 are down 17%. And that's just nominal. You know, the price of the house. Now you add, you know, let's just put 7% inflation on top of that using the government numbers. So you got 7, you know, 17 plus 7. Your house in real value is down 24% in less than a year. And that's the worst case. Other cases, it's not nearly so bad, but San Diego's down 12% and adjusted for inflation. It's add 7 to that. You know, it's down 18%. Seattle's getting hit real hard, which is up near you guys, you know, state of Washington. It's down 16%. So some areas are getting hit really hard, harder than others, but all areas are getting hit. And the only reason it's not down even more is that the supply is way down. People aren't putting their homes on the market. So if for example, it's all about supply and demand. I mean, that's what controls price. So if demand falls by 30%, just hypothetically, and supply falls by 30%, you still have equilibrium, hypothetically, at the old price. So supply is still restricted. And one of the reasons it's still restricted is a lot of people bought their houses with, you know, 3% or less loans during 2022, and so they can still afford that home, and they don't have to sell, because the economy is still relatively strong, unemployment is still, you know, at near record lows, so they don't have to sell. But if somebody else, a new person stepping into the market, that, you know, let's say you bought your home for, here in California, the median size home is like, let's just call it $900,000 for the entire state. Okay, if mortgage rates were 3%, and you bought that home with a 3% mortgage, your payment, let's say, maybe like $1,500 a month. So if somebody else wants to buy that home in today's market, and you still want your you know, $900,000 price at 6.5% mortgage rate, that mortgage rate goes from $1,500 a month. That's just an example, up to $2,500 a month. People can't afford a 40% increase in their mortgage rate. They can't. Wages are slowly going up, but it certainly haven't gone up 40% in a year. So it's a standoff. But here's what happened. Everybody on your block, let's say you have a block and there's 10 houses on it, and they're all worth $1,000,000. Nobody has to sell. So the last sale on the block was at $1,000,000. So that's market value. One person, for whatever reason, has to sell. A death, a divorce, they lose their job, whatever. And all of a sudden, they put that home on the market today at a 6.5% interest rate as compared with 3% a year ago. That home could sell for $750,000. Every home on that block, the last sale, is what prices all the rest. Now every home on that block isn't worth $1,000,000. It's worth $750,000. So that's what will eventually happen. Somebody has to sell. Somebody's going to have to give in. And all of it is going to get priced at a lower number, and that's the new fair market value.
Some people believe home prices will stabilize and then take off again. Is that likely?
Nope, not likely at all. One thing very few people understand is during the last two real estate downturns from 90 to 96 in the United States, from 2006 to 2012, interest mortgage rates actually fell 2 to 3 percentage points during those downturns. So mortgage rates that, you know, contrary to popular belief, aren't the tail that wags the dog. No, it's other things. It's market psychology. But yeah, you can have falling interest rates and falling housing prices. In fact, that tends to be the correlation. It tends to be inversely correlated, you know, with interest rates. And you can have rising housing prices with rising interest rates. So focusing on interest rates is the wrong place to put your focus. I reveal five key timing indicators in my book, Timing the Real Estate Market, and interest rates is one of them. But interestingly, that has the lowest weighting of any of the other indicators. And the other indicators, just to let you know what they are, they're existing home sales, new home building permits, mortgage defaults, and foreclosures. But the lowest weighting I give is to interest rates, because it's not correlated with price movement.
All markets cycle, including the housing market, are extreme highs in home prices, likely to be followed by extreme lows. And what could those extreme lows look like?
Well, I mean, the easiest way, and the way I discovered how to track the market is you just should look at long-term charts, everybody. Look at a chart. Go back 50 years and watch because the whole world is cyclical. Everything goes up, everything goes down. Everything goes up, everything goes down. So find what was occurring at the time when housing prices went up. What was occurring when housing prices went down? And also, there's only three principles in the field of economics that have any value. One is the law of supply and demand. Two is there's no free lunch. Somebody has to pay. And three is that everything reverts back to the mean. And what that means, things get too high, and they revert back to too low. And when things were too low, they revert back to too high. That's the cyclical nature of markets, especially real estate. And I've taken the U.S. housing market back 50 years and done my reversion to the mean cyclical work. And based on past cycles, I think that the U.S. housing market is going to fall anywhere between 40% and 50% on a real basis when adjusted for inflation. So the U.S. housing market, for example, could only fall, your million-dollar house could only fall to $850,000. Okay, you lost 50% of your money, right? Wrong. Why? Because inflation was going off at 8% for those 5 years. Wow, that's 40%. Yeah, exactly. So add 40% loss because of the purchasing power of the currency, add that onto the absolute drop of 15%, and you got a 55% drop. So it's going to be a combination of inflation eating away your money or absolute drop in price. And you don't know what's which, but one way or another, we're going to get to a 40% fall in housing prices, very similar to what we had in the last housing bubble and here in the United States. And this housing bubble was even more extreme.
Central bank digital currencies are being pushed. A lot of people are already saying no thanks. Are there likely to be workaround options to avoid those digital currencies, and where are they likely to come from?
Well, I absolutely think that those digital currencies, where they track every dollar that you spend and every dollar that you receive, I mean, that may work for some people, but that's not going to work for all people. For example, the Mexican drug cartel, dope addiction isn't going anywhere but up, like it always has. So El Chapo wants to sell you $100 million worth of cocaine, let's say. You go down to Mexico. You think he's going to accept a digital currency in exchange for his coke? No, he's not. He'd be an idiot to do that. Anybody would be an idiot to do that. So what he's going to do, we're going to get into a black market situation where there's going to be an alternative medium of exchange. And what I can think of, like if I was El Chapo, I'd say, okay, you owe me let's just say you owe me $50 million. Okay, I'm not going to take $50 million in a digital currency. No, I might as well just walk into the jail and get arrested right there. I want $50 million in gold coins. That's my accepted payment. If you go, I don't have the gold coins, you go, well, you better get them, buddy, because the demand is that your clients want coke, right? Well, of course, then get gold coins. Or they'll get silver coins. Or organized crime. You think all of a sudden these guys are ruthless too. You think they're going to accept a digital payment in exchange for $10 million of stolen product? No. They're going to take gold or silver. And the reason I say those is because they're the most portable. I mean, what else could they take? They could take barrels of oil. I don't think El Chapo is going to have, $5 billion worth of barrels of oil in his backyard. That's just not going to work. But that's the way it's going to work. And even things like prostitution. A prostitute's not going to accept a digital currency. That's against the law. You're going to get arrested. So you'd probably end up with silver coins. But I think if they tried that digital thing, a very vibrant black market is going to develop where people will find a way to get around it.
How important is it to have confidence?
Having confidence is so important, guys. One thing I've come to the conclusion as I get older, everybody wants to be successful, but nobody wants to try hard enough. You have to try, guys. You have to try. And when you have confidence, that gives you the ability to try. You're not afraid to fail, so you'll give things a try. Hopefully you have a brain in your head that you'll take high-probability endeavors. You just won't go doing something stupid that has one chance in 100 of working out, but you got to try. And to develop that confidence, here's what you do. You get your body. Here's the easiest way I know to do it. You get your body in top physical shape. You become healthy and fit. Then you become when you become healthy and fit, then all of a sudden that works on your brain. That develops mental strength. Mental strength. You know you're strong, and all of a sudden you got the ability to say, like, look, I can deal with this. I can deal with anything. You have that kind of confidence. And then once you have that kind of confidence, then you'll try things. So is it easy to get ahead in life? No, not at all. But there's the framework for doing it. You gotta be, the easiest way, you get physically fit, which spills over into mental fitness, and when you're mentally fit, you're confident, and when you're confident, you're not afraid to try things. And the only way you're gonna get ahead in life, if you really wanna outperform, you gotta try things. So yes, you have to have confidence.
How difficult is it for people to stand up for themselves?
I think it's very difficult, and that's part of that mental confidence that I was just referring to. That, once you have the confidence, you will stand up for yourself. You're not aggressive by any means. You're not hostile, but you won't, if somebody approaches you in an aggressive situation, you're not going to back down. It could be a verbal argument. You're not going to back down. Or for some challenge, you're not going to back down. And I have to tell you guys, I was over walking my beagles, and I told Jim this story, I'll tell you guys about standing up for yourself. I was walking my beagles in this big playground, and I saw this 40-year-old man throwing a football with his 15-year-old kid. I said, hey, that's great, and I walked over to him. I said, hey, throw me the ball. And he threw me the ball, and it was a real nice football. It was an official NFL ball with, all made of leather and everything, and the seams were made of leather. And I said, can I throw it to you? And I said, fine. I said, I have to back up, because I could throw a football farther rather than shorter. So I backed up quite a way and threw him the football. And his comment to me was, you can really throw a football. And I said, yeah, I can. Thank you. I love throwing a football. And then all of a sudden, a buddy of mine that I knew, that knew the neighbor that was throwing with his kid, he came walking by and he said, that guy over there can throw a football farther than you. And I said, you want to bet? How much money you want to lose? So I told the guy, I said, back up. The guy was throwing the football with, back up, back up, back up. Because I was going to really let it go. And he looked at me and smiled because he was a really nice guy. And he said, I don't want to do this. Because he knew I could throw a football farther than him. And then I asked the guy with the big mouth, I said, you think you could throw a football farther than me? And I didn't know if he could throw a football, but I'm up for the challenge. He thinks I can't throw a football. and he walked away. So that's just one example, guys. I didn't go out looking for that challenge, but somebody put the challenge up, and I stood up for myself. Said, want to bet? How much money you want to lose? And he's just looking at me, and so I was going to say, I was just going to throw the ball, and I can throw a football, you know, 40 yards in the air. And that's not bad for somebody my age. You know, they'll be 76 in a month. And that guy knew he couldn't throw a ball 40 yards. But that's what I mean standing up for yourself. I wasn't looking for trouble, and it wasn't even sort of being trouble. But all of a sudden, if somebody wants to, like, challenge you and say, you can't do that, if I know I can do that, even if I think I can do it, I'm going to try to do it. And even if I lose, even if that guy could throw the football farther than me, I'd look at him and say, that's good, man. You can really toss the football. But you got to be up for the challenge. You can't back down. You can't be afraid to fail.
Does the saying, you can fool the audience, but you can't fool the players, apply in today's world?
It implies in all worlds. That's one of my favorite all-time sayings. That I've been around the real estate market my entire life. And I'll tell you, that I've seen these guys come and go, and that they're out there telling you how to do this, how to be successful doing this, anybody can do this, blah, blah, blah. Well, and the audience, most of them get sucked into this get-rich-quit mentality. Well, I'm not that audience. I'm a player. I know that's false. I play the game. And what you're saying is, yeah, can it be done? Yes. Is it a low? Do you have a high probability of being successful? What you're doing? No, you do not. Because I've seen people try it and fail. So that's where experience comes in, guys. You have to deal with people that have been experienced, Like I won't have any intelligent discussion about real estate cycles with anybody that hasn't personally experienced two complete cycles. So that's 30 years. Just call it 30 years. Now you've experienced the ups, the downs. You know what it's like to make money. You know what it's like to lose money. And you've done that more than once. Now you can talk from experience, because the real world experience beats school education 10 times to 1. 10 times to 1. What they teach you in school, in college. I mean, I have a degree in econ from UCLA. Did I learn econ at UCLA? No, I didn't. I learned how to play volleyball at a high level. But I did graduate. It took me 30 years to figure out economics. But that's the rule of that. That's where you get your education. It's after college. So you need that experience. And the only way you're going to get experience is you have to try things. You have to find out what it's like to fail. Because if you think you're going to go through life without failing, you're living in a dream world, friends. I mean, that's not the way the world works. But if you get knocked down, the old saying is you got to get up, and that's what you do. But you're up to meet the next challenge. You got to try.
What do you have for us on health and fitness, or did you just give us a good example of that a few minutes ago?
I just gave you a good example of that. Get physically fit, guys. And the physical strength develops mental strength, develops confidence, and the ability to say, I can do that. I will try that. And so other than that approach, I would say keep your weight down, everybody. You gotta keep your weight down. You gotta be lean and strong and fast. Like, I mean, I hired a trainer at the gym, and we're training, we're doing Navy SEAL training. We're doing burpees, I'm pushing a sled, I'm sprinting, all that kind of thing. And is it hard? Yeah, it's really, really hard. But what that does is getting my body lean and strong and fast, and it's given me not only the physical strength, but the mental strength and the confidence, guys. So in other words, you can develop that. Because when you know that you're strong, and you know that you're mentally strong too, you'd be surprised what you can do. Don't limit yourself. And there is no finish line. There is no finish line. You got to keep going. You know where the finish line is? Where you stop and you drop 6 feet into your grave. Then it's over. Until then, keep moving forward. And if you can run and sprint, all the better. But just keep going for it. And that's what makes life so good. It's always a big adventure. Always a big adventure. Yeah, so like somebody challenged you. In fact, that guy that challenged me about throwing the football, the guy I know, he's 30 years younger than me. And he's in better shape than I am. He's in great shape. But he challenged me. He goes, I know how far my neighbor can throw the football. And I bet you can't. I bet you can't throw the ball that far. You go, boy, are you going to be wrong. And you can meet the challenge. And you just don't know how satisfying little things like that are. They are. I mean, I would have met the challenge anyway, even if he could throw the ball, even if the guy was an ex-NFL football player. I'd challenge him to a throw. Would he beat me? Yeah. But would I be able to throw the ball farther than he probably thinks I can? Absolutely. And he'd probably go, that's good. Just like that guy, he didn't want to meet the challenge. So that's all about mental toughness, guys. You don't back down from a challenge. It's just a fair challenge. You know, it's not life or death or anything. But you say, I'll do that. Want to race? I'll race you. And that develops an attitude where you're willing to try things. And you're not going to be successful in everything. No way. But if you're more successful than you're unsuccessful in your endeavors, as long as you manage your own risk and don't put all your money on a losing endeavor where you got to go all the way back to start, you'll live a magnificent life. You'll be financially secure. And people will respect you.
How can people find out more about your book and newsletter?
They can go to my website, realestatetiming.com, and they can read about me. There's a sample newsletter on there. They can see what I do. Also, I have a blog. You might want to sign up for my blog. A lot of people, I share a lot of my insights and principles about being a better person, a better investor on my blog. And I have, I think I have like 2,000 subscribers on it right now. So that's something. I give you a taste of what you're missing if you don't subscribe to my timing letter. But it's, I'm real proud of what I do, and I'm good at what I do. And that's one more thing, guys. As you get older, I'm 75 years old. I'm going to work until the day I die because I'm good at what I do, and it's a steady source of income. And the biggest defense you can have to financial disaster is have a reliable source of income. Be good at something. Because if you like what you do and you're good at it, why stop? Just keep going forward. And then you're comfortable financially, which gives you a confidence. You know, nobody's going to say to you, you have to do this or you're going to starve. No, wrong. You know, wrong. I don't have to do that. I can do whatever I want to do. And so you develop that from an early age. Early age, save your money. If you make a buck, save 10 cents, or hopefully 15 cents on every buck. Learn how to invest it, and then pretty soon you get to be my age, and you got more money than you know what to do with. I mean, I don't need Rolex watches and running around in $250,000 Ferraris to show people I'm a success, you know. I'd rather just challenge some guy that he can't throw a football farther than me. That's priceless. That's all I have to say, guys, for this issue. And, Jim, I really appreciate you this call once again.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you. You're welcome. Bye.
My guest has been Robert Campbell, publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter. He was speaking to us from San Diego. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Rick Ackerman, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.